online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
This week, Sukhinder Singh, renowned collector of whiskey. We'll talk about his journey with brother Rajbir from family off-license to founding and ultimately selling the Whiskey Exchange, building their own distillery, his plans for the year as IWSC industry champion, and what drives his love of miniatures. Sukhinder Singh and his brother Rajbir grew up in small-scale retail, helping their parents run an off-license in Hanwell called The Nest. Around the turn of the millennium, they launched into a new world, online, establishing the Whiskey Exchange, inspired in large part by Sukhinder's already extensive collection of whiskey, which began with a love of miniatures. Having built a hugely successful business, they then sold it 3 years ago to Pernod Ricard to focus their efforts on making whiskey, even building a brand new distillery on Islay to complement their Speyside distillery, Tormore. Sukhinder has recently been honoured with the role of IWSC Industry Champion for this year in recognition of his work for the drinks industry. And I'm delighted to say he joins us now. Welcome, Sukhinder.
Thank you.
You've got a very, frankly, very inspiring story, I think. Take us back, if you would, to your start in life. You and your brother were kind of very much raised in retail, weren't you?
Yeah, correct. It's really in our blood. You know, I guess we never really thought about it until maybe, you know, last 5 or 10 years, when you realize how invaluable that upbringing was to you know, where we are today. But for us, it was just normal day to day. So our parents opened their first liquor shop off license in 1972. So we celebrated 50 years a couple of years ago. You know, we used to live on top of the shop, so it was really our playground. It was somewhere we came to after school in the holidays, and you know, just surrounded by thousands of different bottles from wines, beers, spirits, and that's really, I guess, you know, we were just brought into it. But never ever had a plan of joining the business. If anything, we probably disliked it in many ways because the hours were very, very long. So, you know, we sacrificed a lot. We didn't have many friends. We didn't go out much. It was because mum and dad were just very, very busy. So good and bad.
Your parents were very much ahead of their time, I think, in terms of the ranging that they did, because I remember offies in the 1980s, and you know, it wasn't frankly always the most inspiring place to find a great bottle of wine, but actually they had an extraordinary range, didn't
they? Yeah, you're absolutely right. It was very chain led. There was Threshers, which of course now is, you know, a completely different beast. There were very few independents from what I recall. They were really inspired by a gentleman who used to come to their grocery shop, who used to push them and say, open a drink shop. You know, I'm very versed with alcohol and I will help you, but we need a good off license in the area. So he's the one that really pushed them. And I guess with my parents, I guess they just looked at it and said, well, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it properly. So they reached out to different wine importers, beer specialists of the time, open an account with every single drinks company that they could find, and really stacked the shop high. You know, we had very, very high shelves full of, you know, XO cognacs and things like that, and single malts and liqueurs from around the world. And that's what I vividly remember about the shop being so different, is the vast majority of how many, in terms of every category, wine, spirits and beers that we actually had.
And you are, by any measure, a collector extraordinaire. When did you develop this love of whiskey in particular?
I think initially, I mean, it was through miniatures. So as a family, we collected miniatures, and I just got fascinated really by miniatures. What happened was that there was a particular customer who came in and used to bring different people to our shop to buy miniatures. So I got speaking to him and realized that there was a club. And I thought, fine, it'd be interesting to advertise, you know, what we do, what we sell. But I actually found the magazine very interesting. And I just thought, you know what? I can see me collecting miniatures. I think collecting, everyone has an element of collecting within them. And I, as a child, used to collect stamps, but I got bored at one point. And for me, it was like, you know, I guess I was looking for something else to collect. And miniatures fascinated me because I understood the trade. And it was like, you know, okay, I can handle tiny little bottles, easy to manage, easy to display. So I joined the club and really just started to understand that, you know, you could collect everything, but it's good to specialize. And for some reason, I ended up with Scotch. I don't know how many miniatures I had, not a lot, but I ended up with Scotch. And then what happened was, I was offered a very large collection of 7,000 miniatures, which I thought was completely out of reach and was, it was completely insane in terms of how the heck could anyone have so many miniatures. I went to see this collection. It was down in Bath, sitting with some liquidators, because it was a very complicated story. I'm not going to go there, but so they asked me, I asked them, how much will the collection be worth? And they go, look, we have no idea. There's been a lot of interest, but, you know, this is the closing date. It's sealed tender. So just put in a bid to us and we will have a look at it. I said, look, okay, I'll phone you on the day and just get a gist of, you know, if you can help me or guide me, because, you know, I'm a young guy, I don't have a lot of money, but I think this is going to be out of my reach. I phoned them on the deadline and they told me that they hadn't received any offers. So I go, what do I offer? They said, up to you. I said, okay, I offer £1,000. And basically they accepted it. So I bought 7,000 miniatures for £1,000, which in those days was still a lot of money. But I could see that it was a sensibly priced collection. And I guess that's when I decided to specialize from, even more so from Scotch to single malt whiskey, because I was sort of researching single malts, and even in the shop, I found single malts as probably the most interesting category. You know, the type of clients that used to come to buy single malts were a bit more refined, a bit more educated, and I just had some very nice intellectual conversations with them. And that for me was like something which just sparked the interest that, wow, single malts are special, but I didn't know much about them. So the miniature journey really helped me on that path to understand, you know, how many different distilleries there were. And then with miniatures, I was collecting variations over time, and really I just grew it. And I think over a course of like 10 years, I ended up with around 5,000 different single malt whiskey miniatures, which I know at the time was by far the largest collection in the world. So that's how I started with I guess, my passion or interest in whiskey, and my collecting side.
It's an extraordinary story, and there'll be lots of people listening who know you who'll be thinking, well, thank goodness he went off stamps, quite frankly. You know, what is it about the miniature? Because you're not alone in loving minis, but what is it about the miniature that makes them so exciting?
I think for me, being a young guy with limited budget, it was affordable and manageable in terms of how much space you needed. You know, I think the vision of buying large bottles, which I never even thought about at the time, and just trying to find place to keep them is not easy. It's not easy for anyone. So I think a lot of people are attracted to the fact that small is manageable. You know, you can keep it in your loft, you can keep it in the barn, you know, in the shed, wherever. It's not that bad. So I think it's more to do with that.
And you've graduated from miniatures to the big ones. Tell us about your collection of whiskey, because I know a lot of people rather envy it.
You know what? It just started off as really, I just more for interest. Initially, it started off that I was going to learn about the industry. I was going to learn about the different distilleries through collecting. My initial goal was to collect one bottle from each distillery. But I didn't want to just go to the shop and just pick up a bottle of a current version. I decided that I was going to collect the older versions, you know, back from the 70s and 80s. And things which were no longer around. And I think what I did, which was probably sensible, was I initially said to myself, take your time. You know, even if you buy two bottles a year or three bottles a year, but you buy good bottles, that's good enough. Because I'm a young guy, I've got plenty of years ahead of me. I don't want to buy everything in one, you know, in one go. Of course, I couldn't afford it, but it was more interest that you pick up two or three bottles a year, you do a lot of research in between, and then you know what to look for next. And that's really how it started. And that was probably in the late 80s. But then I guess after 4 or 5 years in collecting and maybe, you know, 30, 40 bottles in, I started noticing a huge change in the single malt whiskey market, where brands started realizing that there's a bit of interest starting, and they started creating and releasing slightly more aged single malts. And I think the first product that really captivated me was a whiskey called Black Bamore. And initially, of course, it was purely because of the packaging. It was limited edition, 2,000 bottles. But the packaging was sensational. Black box, clear glass bottle with whiskey, which was virtually black in color, hence the name Black Bamore. 29 years old, and I think the price was around £65, and that was 1993. And that's for me when I started noticing that, you know, companies have just started releasing stuff. And I was like, I've already got a Bowmore, but this is so beautiful. I asked about the whiskey. I got a chance to try the whiskey and blew my mind. And I was like, I've got to have one of these. And then somebody else did something. I was like, oh my God, this is delicious. I have to have one of these. So it was probably in the mid 1990s that for me, my initial vision of one from each distillery finished. And I just started buying what I liked. Yeah, I kept still collecting the old bottles, but as new stuff was launched, I only bought what I really found interesting. And then I started buying bottles with a view that I also wanted to learn about the liquid. You know, it's all well keeping a bottle for its looks, but I wanted to understand liquid. And I bought two, three older bottlings and opened them. And that's when it completely blew my mind in terms of, I had heard about how whiskey changed in a bottle, evolved once you opened it, changing the glass. And once you open the bottle, as you drink through it, and with every sip, you pick up new notes, new differences, new nuances. And that education, which I taught myself, in the mid-90s, was just, for me, the be-all and end-all of where I am today. It was, for me, it was actually a very lonely place. I didn't have many people I could talk to about whiskey. I was doing it by myself. I knew no other collectors. I met later than a few collectors in Europe, and we used to write letters to each other to do swaps. You know, they used to say, I've heard, for example, Black Bowmore has been launched. Can you get me a bottle? And I was like, yes, I can. Would you like to buy it? Or do you have something to swap against it? So, you know, that's how it started. And then I also met a lovely gentleman called John Milroy, who owned this whiskey shop in London called Milroy's. And he was really, it was his business was the first whiskey shop probably in the world. I think that was back in the 70s, if I'm not wrong. And, you know, there were some books written by his brother, Wallace, and I just really wanted to meet him. And we actually hit it off that first meeting. He was just so nice to me. And, you know, then I used to go maybe once a month to town and just come and see him. And he just took me under his wing. He used to call me Sukhinder Sun. A very lovely man, still around, of course, retired, doesn't own the business anymore, but he was a great inspiration to me.
That's lovely. Why, by the way, would a whiskey be almost black? I maybe should know the answer to that question, but I've been racking my brains thinking, why would it be black?
It's mainly to do with the type of cask maturation. So in this case, it was from a first fill sherry cask and very long aging, 29 years old in a beautiful old sherry cask, and it takes on color.
Right.
Thing is, sherry cask today are seasoned or created in a very different way to when they were a long time ago. So the type of color you get, the type of taste you get are quite different. But traditionally, bourbon casks give you light, fruity notes, more coconut, vanilla, whereas sherry notes give you more spice, rich, raisins, darker notes.
Mm.
And traditionally, a lot of the distillers fill both, and then use the two components to really, you know, blend together to create their final product. So I think a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the whiskeys out there are like, you know, maybe 80% bourbon, 20% sherry, or 90% bourbon, 10% sherry. Everyone's got their own recipe. Of course, today there's a trend towards more heavily sherried. So the proportion of sherry, which is going up in these blends, in these vattings, is predominantly more sherry.
In the time that you have been both learning about whiskey, and it's incredibly impressive that you're largely self-taught, and also collecting whiskey, the price has adjusted upwards rather significantly, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think you have to remember, it didn't for many, many years. When I started collecting back in the late 80s, my first big bottle I bought was probably in the late 80s, 88 from memory. I bought them just because I was fascinated by the history and, you know, how old they were. You know, my first bottle was a bottle from around 1910. And for me, it was more a piece of history than it was, you know. I never even thought of whiskey being as an investment. I genuinely didn't. Didn't have a clue it would be at any one point. But over time, as I started buying, following the market, I realized that, you know, things do go up. But I would say for the first good 10 years, 15 years, if I started in the 80s, till around, I'd say 2014, 2015, prices, I guess, as a percentage, they still went up, you know, maybe 200-300%, which is good. But I guess monetary-wise, it didn't feel like it was a great investment. if you see what I mean. No one, people talk about investment because you're suddenly seeing big pound notes in front of you. And I think that's what happened from 2014, 2015, is the numbers just started jumping and the percentages were insane. So, for example, I did some research. Let's say a bottle of Glendronach 1968, I would say came out for about 50 or 60 pounds when it originally did, which was, I can't even remember, 93 maybe, probably a bit more than that. And then by the mid, I was checking around 95, 96, I think it was selling for about 400 pounds a bottle, which, you know, from whatever, 50, 60 to 400, pretty damn good. But from around 2014, 15, so 20 years later, the prices just started going up from 500 to 600 to 700 to 800. And today you're talking 2000 a bottle. So for me, I never really noticed it, but I guess I got to a point where I thought I better insure my collection. And that's when you suddenly wake up and realize, oh boy, this has done pretty well. But I, even today when I buy, I never look at it as an investment because sometimes I'm paying over the odds just to get a bottle. I know I paid too much, but it just fits into my collection and my profile, and it's something I've got a whole, you know, I'm missing this bottle. It's been something I've been looking for the last 20 plus years. So when you get it, you sometimes have to pay over the odds. So for me, when you look at it that way, is it a good investment? I don't think so. Will it prove its time, prove its worth over time? 100%. But you know, you, with any investment, you have to look at it very long term. You know, if you go and buy shares, they always say, please don't look at it for at least 5 years, probably 10 years. And I would say the same with whiskey. If you're going to look at it, think of it at least 5 to 10 years, if not even longer, then you could do well.
Well, talking of numbers, you brought together your love of collecting and your knowledge that you acquired through that with your experience of retail. As you said, it sort of runs in your blood. When you and your brother founded the Whiskey Exchange, it went on to be a household name amongst drink lovers anyway, and a huge success. It was sold to Pernod Ricard about 3 years ago now. Just tell us about how you and your brother went about establishing that business and why you did it.
We both ended up in the business. As I said, neither of us actually wanted to, but I couldn't find a job after university. So I thought, okay, I'll help out for a while. And I actually fell in love with the business and I changed the business completely. I changed the product selection. I changed the displays and you know, the margins that we were making on products. So I found it really interesting and I fell in love with it. And I just thought, fine, I can do this. So my father had always talked about expanding the shop. So I asked him at the time, I said, look, if I stay and work, can I expand the shop? And he goes, fine. I said, but no restrictions. I'll do whatever I want. He goes, yeah, fine. He didn't have the time anyway. So we created, you know, I did a lot of research. We created, you could say, today what would be like a modern day equivalent of an Oddbins, yeah? But Oddbins sort of didn't really exist at those in that time. What we created was incredible. It was like, I think it was about 2,000 square feet of retail space. And we loved it. And we won award after award after award, lots of lovely drinks industry awards. But we got to a point then in the late 90s where generally business was getting, I would say, a bit dirty in terms of bootlegging from Europe. It wasn't fun. And also, mum and dad were thinking about retiring. We really wanted them to retire. So we convinced them to sell the shop, you know, take it easy. But while I was at the Nest in my parents' business, I had sort of started buying and selling and making the shop a bit of a specialist for whiskey, because of all these people I had met, customers abroad, etc. So, as I said, I really focused on that. So when we sold the business, I spoke to my brother. I said, look, I'm thinking about doing a whiskey company. you know, would you join me? It'd be good to get support. And he goes, fine, let's do it. And we really didn't know what to expect. So we just planned that we would run it for a year, try. And if everything went well, we would continue. If it didn't, we would, you know, close down and just, I guess, get a proper job. And we didn't know what that meant at the time. So really, we created the Whiskey Exchange back in 1999. The main reason for the name was because it was exactly that. I was buying old and rare whiskies and selling them to people around the world. So it was a perfect place to, whether you buy, sell, or exchange. And that's where the name came about. Initially, you know, we were like, should we buy a shop or open a shop in town? We were going to buy Milroy's, but it didn't happen. And then one of our friends suggested, he goes, why don't you look at online? And we were like, great, sounds great, but online is expensive to build a website. You know, this was really at the infancy. And we had seen these companies around us advertising the papers, you know, looking for huge investments to build websites. And I mean, I'm talking about £1 million for building a website, but I guess that's corporate. And our friend goes to us, he goes, look, you know, don't worry. I've done computer science at university and I'll build you a website. And I'll charge you 10,000. And we were like, well, we can afford that. So let's give it a punt. So we just bought a little warehouse, waited while the website was built for us. And really, I guess, you know, we were sensible, courageous. I guess the main thing which we had was confidence, because we had the knowledge. You know, we'd been doing it for a good 10 plus years, 15 years, and full time. And we were just, you know, it was just like, we understand spirits, understand whiskey, so let's give it a go. And really, it took off from day one. I would say that our timing was phenomenal. 99 for me was really one of the key eras for whiskey, for single malts. So many new companies started up. A lot of stock was sort of discovered, you could say. It was, you know, it had been sitting idle for many, many years waiting to be blended away. But actually, all of a sudden, because single malts were becoming important, then these people just thought, well, let me just sell these parcels of stock for single malt rather than blending, because nobody wants blends anymore, or the demand is less so. So many new companies started up. And for us, you know, we were one of the key specialists at the time. So everybody would come to us first and say, you know, are you interested? And we would like, let's try the liquid. If the liquid's good, yep, we'll happily take it. And what was lovely about that era was we were still getting whiskies which were distilled in the 1960s and the 1970s, you know, as 20-year-old, 25-year-old, 30-year-olds. I know that sounds very old whiskey today, but in those days, it was old whiskey, but there was a lot of it. You know, there was a lot sitting there which was, as I said, originally destined or kept aside for aged blends, but the blended market was disappearing. So it was a phenomenal time. I think some of the best whiskies I've ever tried were bottled around then, 99, 2000, up to 2004, 2005. And we just bought and bought and sold and sold. We had customers all over the world buying from us, some placing orders on a weekly basis because of the selection we had. You have to remember that whiskey wasn't single malts weren't very openly exported to different countries of the world. You know, they were just the big brands and that was it. And an occasional, you know, single cask bottling here and there. But we became a true specialist in every sense of the word. And also alongside all the new products we were selling, we were specializing in old and rare whiskies. You know, I was buying, I'd made so many contacts around Scotland, a lot of distillery workers, ex-distillery workers, distillery managers, and they would just recommend people to me to say, there's only one guy for the job if you're looking at selling your old and rare whiskey. So I was getting, you know, some amazing offers on a weekly basis, and that would just help top up our stock to be able to sell to the world around us.
Mm, you should write a book, really. I mean, this business was, you know, specializing in whiskey, but then it spawned a number of other successful businesses, including Cocktail Week here in London. It was a great expansion success story. How did you and your brother go about expansion?
Everything just came naturally. You know, the timing was right. It was the next step which made sense to us. So initially when we started the Whiskey Exchange, it was just whiskey. And then 4 or 5 years later, we just felt that, you know, we had proved ourselves on whiskey, but no one was still doing a good job in terms of mixed spirits. So we brought mixed spirits into our mix as well. And then we got an opportunity to open a shop, a physical shop. So a lot of customers used to email us and say, I've been buying from you for the last few years. We love your selection. Do you have a shop we could come to? And we used to say, no, we have a little warehouse and you're more than welcome to come to. But I think they found it a bit tedious to travel, you know, all the way to West London to a little warehouse stuck in the middle of nowhere. So when we got an opportunity for a shop, which was actually in Vinopolis in London Bridge, you know, we just said, yeah, this sounds great. So we did that first shop. A few years later, we looked at, you know, I was traveling around the world to great whiskey shows. Germany was one of the first places in the world to start amazing whiskey shows. UK had a small one. Japan started one. And I was following. I went to the Netherlands. I went to Belgium. I went to Germany regularly. I just thought the best form of education for consumers is by liquid to lips. Let them try liquid, let them learn. You know, as an online merchant, it's quite hard. You can describe them as much as you want, but people need to try this liquid. You know, there was so much happening, and people's knowledge was so minimal that it just made so much sense. So we started the whiskey show over 15 years ago now. And again, it was tough. One thing we did, which was very different, you know, the other shows were a bit more commercial. And for me, I didn't want to compete on the same territory. Because so many beautiful aged whiskies were being launched, you know, at £100 plus, you know, like the Black Blackburn, like all these single cask whiskies from independent bottlers, you know, at 25, 30 years of age. Nobody was willing to pour those whiskies away at shows when you're charging £20 a door ticket, because it just becomes a bit of fun and a cheap night out, you could say. So we just looked at it and thought, let's create a show which is really premium, yeah, where brand owners would be really happy to show off their aged whiskies. So if we get the right customer for them, they'll do it. And I remember the first show which we launched, I think our ticket price was something like £80, which 15 years ago was a lot of money. Brands were nervous, but everyone supported us because we were good customers. And honestly, it was a great success from year one. And, you know, wasn't a big show. I think we got 250, 300 people over 2 days. Next year, we got 500 or 600. Next year, we got 700 or 800. We just grew it, and now we're sold out at 2,000 people a day, you know, and we're doing 2 days of 4,000 people. Sometimes we're doing 3 days and that's 2,500 people. So it was just natural progression and best form of marketing that you could ask for. After that, you know, we got an opportunity because we were doing mixed spirits. We wanted to do something similar in mixed spirits. And we had the opportunity to take over London Cocktail Week. So we thought, okay, let's do that. So we took that over a few years later as the collectible market started getting really buoyant. And, you know, people were buying and selling bottles through auction. We said, okay, we have to do an auction site. To be fair, we would have done it probably 4 or 5 years earlier, but we were growing at such a pace that we just didn't have the time capacity to do so. We were actually more interested in expansion. We had to find a new warehouse. We had to kit the warehouse up. We had to build a full internal team for web development. You know, I think one of our key successes was the fact that we did everything in-house. We did all design in-house. We did all development in-house. We did all editorial content in-house, which gave us a lot of power to make quick decisions and do things in a sensible, timely manner.
You built this extraordinary business, as you say, in a kind of way that was like a natural expansion, organic expansion, I suppose. Why then did you decide to sell it?
It was something which was not planned at all. I think, look, in the back of our mind, you always know, you know, when people ask you questions, what's the future? What's the future? And we just said, we don't know, because we're doing a good job. We're growing the business. I guess if we get to a point where we feel we can't do much more, it'll probably be time. But at that time, we were absolutely fine. We had great ambitions of doing lots of different things. We wanted to restructure the team to take us to the next phase. But then I guess we got talking to Perno. We took on an advisor just to get some sensible, sound, independent advice. I guess we were told, look, you'd be silly not to look at it. You know, you might kick yourself later. So we said, okay, fine, we'll have a look at it. And really, I guess after that, everything comes down to, you know, who's the right partner? You know, are they paying a handsome price? So everything sort of ticked the boxes. They were also a family-owned company. You know, for us, making sure our staff, our team, which was a big team of close to 200 people, you know, were happy. So, you know, we worked with the senior management team to say, look, we've got an offer, we've got an idea, you know, what do you think? And everyone goes, listen, guys, you know, we trust you. You've done a good job. You know what's right. You know, we'll back you, we'll support you. And they were honestly amazing, absolutely amazing. So we just decided to go with it. And, you know, we were already at that time in the middle of plans to build a distillery on the island of Islay. So, you know, we actually said, you know what, fine. If this goes, we've still got a new challenge, which is distilling. And then as part of, you know, Islay, which is a new distillery, it'll take us many, many years before we have liquid, which is ready. You know, it would be nice to have something, A, which balances Islay, i.e. something in Speyside, and B, something which has some stock so we can get our teeth into while Islay sort of matures, you know, gets ready. And so after the sale, we spoke to Perno and, you know, asked them, or gave them our vision. And they were kind enough to say, okay, fine, we will help you out. And they were kind enough to sell us Tormore Distillery in Speyside with sensible stocks. So that's really our new baby, something we need to get a grips of. So we finished at Whiskey Exchange just going on to 6 months ago. Now we're getting our feet on the ground with the new business. We've had to set up, you know, complete new infrastructure, new team. A few people transferred across, but we're in the middle of recruitment at the moment, and we're probably recruiting anywhere between, I think, 6 to 10 people. Even though things are quite challenging out there, for us, we just need to get ready. And we want to be ready. We've got good brands. You know, we're very liquid focused. And I think what really excites us, David, for the future is, I think, this notion around independence and independent companies. I think if you look at all industries, yeah, especially in the drinks industry, but all categories, there is this thing about consolidation, you know, big brands buying popular products, other popular brands just to own the market. And you know what? Not a bad thing. Similar to us, they bought Whiskey Exchange, you know, they buy brands and they take them to the next level. But I think there comes also a point where you lose the human touch and the human element which makes products special, especially whiskey, you know, which needs a lot of time. It's not just distilling it and putting it in barrel and hope for the best. It's really, there is a science behind it. From every stage, from the barley to the maltings to the distillation process to the cask selection, the maturation, and then of course the last part, which is the blending or putting the different casks and liquid together to create the final product. And all of these, you know, are different skill sets, and I think that human element when you're a big corporate giant is lost because they're working to efficiency. There's this element of each person is doing a lot of different things. You know, they've got multiple job roles. And what I'm finding today is some of the best liquid coming out of distilleries, not just in Scotland, even around the world, is from independents. And you can see the same as a comparable, I look at beer. You know, the big boys have bought up all the big beer brands, and the big beer is boring. It's just such boring, and hence the reason craft brewing has taken off to such an extent. Of course, not everything is good, but there are many, many amazing craft beer companies which are producing beautiful beer, and people have just stopped buying the big brands and gone to the small and saying, you know what, I prefer this. It tastes of something. And I think we're going to find the same in whiskey. I genuinely do. And I think that's where I find really exciting is the fact that I think there's a huge gap in the market, and I think we can make a difference. And I think, you know, when you give consumers liquid, which is just so delicious, that's what whiskey is. It's not, for me, it's not collectible. It can become collectible if the liquid is amazing. That takes time. You need to prove. And as I'm saying, it's a new challenge, but we're really looking forward to it. We've got a great team, lovely, lovely people. And it's something different.
It's exciting as well. Although it is, you know, one thing to love a product, it's another to develop an encyclopedic knowledge of it, as you have, and to collect it. It's quite another to make it, isn't it?
Yep. I guess that's the only part we hadn't touched. I mean, logically, if we would have had the Whiskey Exchange, we would have touched every single point in the chain. We would have been producing and we would have been retailing. So we've got a distribution company. We had a wholesale arm supplying hotels, bars, restaurants. Do you see my point? We would have been one of the few companies who had everything under one belt. But as I said, you know, Whiskey Exchange is now gone. The shows are now gone. Auction is now gone. And you know what? It's nice. We can just focus on distillation. Really going back to basics. This is what I say. And just making good, decent, honest, tasty whiskey. That's what I enjoy. That's what really inspires me. That's why I got into the business. And that's what I'm feeling is missing a little bit today. But when I think about the possibilities and when we put together products, it puts a smile on my face to say, you know what? I can drink this. I want to drink this. And, you know, we've got a good reputation out there, which is nice.
You have. Yeah. I mean, there's a question that we tend to ask at the end of the drinking hour, and it'll be a nightmare for you because it'll be like being asked to pick your favorite child. But we ask for a desert island drink. In this case, I suspect it'll be a desert island dram. So there you are, stuck on a desert island. You can only have one drink. I'm guessing it's going to be a whiskey. Sukhinder, what's it going to be?
I honestly can't answer that question. I find it so difficult. Yeah, and I'll tell you something. You know what? I would say to you at sometimes I would say it might not even be a whiskey. Yeah, I love all spirits. I genuinely do. And, you know, it could be a delicious agricole white rum. It could be a amazing agave led tequila. It could be a beautiful Chartreuse, old Chartreuse, or most likely will be a nice single malt. So it's just too hard. I think when I look at it, if you ask me, you know, I can come with the ballpark in terms of distilleries I love, but I've got so many amazing bottlings from that distillery. I could pick any one of them and I'd be really happy.
You need a container ship probably to your desert island, I suspect, to ship over your collection. No, I rather suspected you might not be too happy about answering that question. But I tell you what, it's fascinating talking to you and it's a really inspiring story. It really is. So just talk briefly about your plans for being industry champion at the IWSC, because it's a huge honor.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think I just want to go with the flow. I'm going to be working with the team at IWSC. You know, they've given different opportunities wherever I can take them. I'll say, yep, happy to help. I think, look, you know, it's an amazing honor, something I would never even expected or dreamt of. But it was lovely. It was, you know, when they asked, I guess for me, it's now, I guess, inspiring the next generation, you know, all my team, for example, you know, I still learn from the team as well as inspiring them. But I think, you know, we just have a nice buzz that they know they're in good hands because I have this vision and I have this passion that I think that's what they thrive on. So I think there's so much, the industry's changed so much. And I think there's so many opportunities to learn so many different parts of the business, not just distillation, you know, marketing is another skill set. So I think one plan we have, this is even outside after this year ends, is at our distilleries, we want to start some sort of like an apprentice program or an education program, especially on Isla, which is an island where, you know, the opportunities are quite limited. So to teach, I think, you know, young aspiring people who want to learn a bit about marketing or, you know, sales or whatever. And if we as a company or as a team can help with bits and pieces of that, I think it'll be really good. But just, you know, whatever we can do, whatever I can do to help inspire, I think it's just important. I really do. For me, I've done literally everything. So, you know, if you can inspire people, why not?
Yeah, well, you'll certainly do that. And I'm looking forward to meeting you in the flesh at the Camden Roundhouse for the annual awards dinner. I'm hosting it, so very much looking forward to that. It's going to be a fun night, I think.
No, well, definitely. I look forward to it.
Sukhinder, thanks very much for joining us on The Drinking Hour.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Oenologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
Well, let's round off with a toast to Sukhinder and a selection of IWSC medal winners. All of these are gold medal winners, starting with one close to home for Sukhinder. Elixir Distillers Elements of Isla Cask Edit Blended Malt Scotch Whiskey. Described this way, soft peat and gentle fruit aromas deliver an attractive nose that evolves with a creamy smokiness on the palate. Elegant and rich with a delightful complexity, enriched with confident port notes and a sweet finish. Next, Glenmorangie Barrel Select Release 12-year-old Amontillado Sherry Cask Single Malt Scotch Whiskey. We were talking about sherry casks earlier, of course. The judging overseen here by Richard Patterson, OBE, supported by Colin Hampton-White, Jim Beveridge, Ludo Ducroc and Billy Layton, quite a panel. They described this way, a perfumed nose showing complexity
and balance through the aroma characteristics of mint, lavender, fresh fruit, malted barley notes, and integrated oak influences. A soft and mellow palate where the aroma characteristics come through and evolve into a good Rancio-like finish. Next, Murray McDavid Cask Craft Peated Finish Glen Elgin Single Malt Scotch Whiskey. A gold again, the judge's tasting note, with an excellent nose and a palate that perfectly complements it, balancing pear drops and just a kiss of peat smoke. The palate has sweet floral notes and plenty of fruit, leading into a creamy toffee on the palate. Here's a gold medal winner crafted for the Co-op. White & Mackay Co-op Irresistible Single Malt Scotch Whisky, praised for its attractive nose of Manuka honey and peanut brittle, with sweet fig and candied orange notes on the palate. A splash of spicy cloves and fine oak, giving balance and texture. The finish is a deliciously sweet, dark, fudgy delight. And finally, it's not all about whisky for Sukhinder, of course. There's rum as well. Elixir Distillers Black Tot Master Blenders Reserve Rum 2022, a gold medal winner, and also scooping a trophy this one, so representing best in show. Here's what the judges, including senior judging committee member Ian Burrell, a previous guest here on the Drinking Hour, had to say. Soft and exceptionally poised, with aromas of bruised and caramelised banana combining with richly indulgent demerara sugar on the nose. Chocolate flows through intricate layers of tropical fruit on the complex palate, with a beautiful oak integration that delivers an enduring and delightful finish. Well, time for my own delightful finish. My thanks to Sukhinder. Best of luck to him for his year as IWSC industry champion. And thanks to you for listening. Until next time, goodbye.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.